Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Press One for Democracy. My name is Dan Aronson, and I'm broadcasting here from the banks of the Willamette River in lovely downtown Portland, Oregon, where we have just been enjoying some lovely summer weather. And while the world has been gotten kind of caught up in some stuff, and we're going to talk about some of that stuff today, and we're going to talk about it with a very, very special guest star. I have to do my shout-out to Bobby Rodrigo, who is not yet listening in, but he will be soon, hopefully, and who has arranged this guest for us. And that is Hesham Omaligi. And I'm going to I'll get into his full bio here in a second, when he calls in, and we can start the interview. So what we're going to talk about tonight, I think, is a great topic. Obviously, it's a very, very current topic. We're going to talk about the trouble in the Middle East thing. I know that in and of itself isn't really news, right? I mean, when isn't there trouble in the Middle East? But, you know, obviously there's been heightened tensions on the between Palestinians and Israelis. And I'm not necessarily sure I want to call it Palestinians and Israelis. I almost want to call it these subversive sects like Hezbollah that live and hunker down within the Palestine borders and cowardly, like most terrorists, right? They cowardly, place themselves amongst innocent people and basically use those people as human shields. And, well, when that doesn't work or when that does work and one of these or two of these innocent people are killed, then, of course, the cry goes out for justice and revenge. And then there has been revenge killings. And it goes back and forth, and of course, it's a downward spiral into the deepest depths of hell. And there's no winners. There's no winners in this, and there never will be until a peaceful political solution can be worked out, and people can learn to coexist side by side, even with the kinds of differences that they have from an ideological perspective. And I think it's kind of almost apropos to have this as a coffee party subject, because of course this is what, you know, coffee party exists for, right? It's like, how can we get these two people to the table, have some respectful, meaningful dialogue, and really have people listening to each other, understanding that there are differences, but always with the idea of looking to overcome those differences, to finding those points of commonality, and to work towards solutions for the better of everyone. And that's Coffee Party's mission here in the U.S. But it's a general form of conflict resolution that resonates around the globe, anywhere that there are these troubled areas. And, you know, I've been spending a lot of time on various Facebook pages, ours, Bridges of the Divide, and others, where, of course, a lot of conversations going on about this. And, you know, a lot of people are commenting, and rightfully so, that in terms of, for lack of a better word, carnage, this is hardly the bloodiest battle that's going on in the world. I mean, you know, in Africa, in places like the Congo, I mean, this is commonplace, and it's been going on for 20 years at levels much higher. I mean, the kinds of atrocities that are being committed, in country, are terrible. And so, you know, people are like, well, why do we have, what is it about the Middle East that we have this affinity for, this love of, or this need to be connected to in a meaningful way, the struggles of these people? And, I think it's a fairly easy question, or an easy answer, and that is because we had a big hand in creating the situation, right? So we had a big hand as part of the UN. Britain was leading the way, but we were right there with our good pals from Great Britain in creating this quote-unquote two-state solution that basically sat two camps next to each other of people that don't necessarily get along that well. So I think, to me, that's why the U.S. has a special affinity for this, because I think there's guilt there. I think we go, well, we kind of caused this, or we certainly had a hand in it. But I see that our guest has joined, so I want to get into his bio. Again, our special guest tonight is Hesham. I knew that I would. I practiced saying his name so many times, and I knew that I would have a problem. But it's El-Maliki, Hesham El-Maliki. And just to give you a little bit of background, Hesham is an interfaith community leader who lives on what he calls the proud and independent state of Staten Island. And that's a conversation I've tried for another show, but to find out why Staten Island is its own state. But his mission in life is to build bridges of understanding and respect between people from different groups, cultures, and backgrounds. He reaches out to the community with his presentations and dialogues about true teachings of Islam and what it is like to be a Muslim in today's world. He has invested more than a decade in interfaith relations, bringing people together in campaigns and events to promote understanding and preserving rights. Again, folks, sound familiar as a mission statement? For his troubles in 2009, in recognition of his tireless work in bridging communities and faith, Mr. El-Maliki received the Peacemaker Award from Peace Action. And again, I could, if I went and just read through his entire resume and his bio, it would probably take the better part of the show. And what I want to do is take some more of his specific work, and as we get into it, and I want to ask him some questions and bring out his experiences and kind of put a frame of reference around where his frame of reference is and why he believes the kinds of things he believes in. So with that, welcome, Hesham, to the show. I really appreciate you joining us. Really excited to have you. How are you tonight?
Thank you, Dan. I'm very excited to be on, and thanks for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. So what I want to do, just so that everybody knows, first of all, this is Press One for Democracy, so this is a call-in show. Mr. El-Maliki will be here to take your calls after we get through about 15, 20 minutes of interview. And that number to call in is 646-929-2495. And when you get in queue, the little nice British lady will tell you that if you want to press get into the conversation, you simply press 1. Right, which hence the name is the show, Press One for Democracy. So some of the more specific works that Hesham has been involved in, the founding member of the Building Bridges Coalition, National Coalition to Protect Civil Freedoms, and Muslims for Liberty. And I want to stop on that one, Muslims for Liberty. And I want to ask you, how are Muslim ideologies, because I think a lot of us have, well, either we don't know a lot about the Muslim religion or we don't, or we have some misconceptions. But religion as a whole seems to be somewhat constraining at times in its dogma, right? So how does the Muslim ideologies and the liberty ideologies, how are they aligned?
Excellent question. Thank you very much. So unlike the popular perception, Islamic teachings, Islamic belief is based on free will. So in the Quran, chapter 2, verse 256, part of the verse or the beginning of it says, لا إكراه في الدين, let there be no compulsion in matters of, sometimes it's translated religion, so let there be no compulsion in matters of religion, but those who are taught in the Islamic sciences, especially particularly the Arabic language, understand that word to be the way of life. So let there be no compulsion in way of life, i.e. in matters of choice. So bottom line is, let there be no compulsion, which is the basic non-aggression principle in the liberty and libertarian principles.
It is, and that's fascinating to know. And I'm sure I'm going to have many satoris, right? If you're familiar with I'm sure you're familiar with the concept of satori. Satori is an Eastern philosophy, and Zen philosophy. It's it's a small spiritual awakening. And I relate it to the light bulb going on over your head. You go, oh, I get it now. So that I'm sure I'm going to have lots of those moments, and I hope our listeners are going to have lots of those moments during this interview. So I'm again, super excited.
I sure hope it's only a light head explosion, because this is very radical in many ways. And actually, that understanding is what brought me to the Liberty Movement. And I was the Libertarian Party candidate last year for New York City Comptroller. So I'm very involved in the Liberty Movement, and it is part and parcel of my Islamic belief. It is not debatable. It's not up for interpretation. There is no compulsion in matters of choice. God is the decider. God is the judge, not us.
So I was going to get to that one a little bit later, but as long as you brought it up, right? So one of the things on your resume, and by the way, big congratulations on this, is that you have been slated by the Libertarian Party of New York City to be their nominee for the New York City controller position. And that's huge. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
But what in this particular instance, this brought up this question in my head, which is, in a country that has codified the concept of separation of church and state, how does someone like yourself, who's been so, who is so steeped in faith, and his faith has been such a huge part of your life, how do you effectively draw the line of demarcation between the two? Or can they coexist? Maybe I'm missing that. I don't want to rule that out as well.
Sure, they can coexist. The Islamic, so-called Islamic government, which is non-existent in today's world in any Muslim-majority country, but the Islamic government is a government that would be very, very, very similar to a government that is founded and based on our American founding documents. So an Islamic government, in effect, is a secular government. You don't need a priest or an imam to run the Ministry of Transportation. You need a professional to run that ministry, but within guidelines of being the Ten Commandments, basically. You know, the Ten Commandments also are founded in the Islamic teachings. So this is a commonality between the Abrahamic religions and anyone else of conscience. Nobody would object to the Ten Commandments. So the two can exist. The correct Islamic government would be a secular government running things, but within moral guidelines. So one thing, for example, to give a concrete example of this, under Islamic law, the teachings of Islam does not allow borrowing with interest. So the Federal Reserve would cease to exist in an Islamic-run state or government. Again, none of today's Muslim-majority countries are Islamic in any sense, except some of them have the name Islamic in their name, like the Islamic Republic of Iran, Islamic Republic of Pakistan. Even Saudi Arabia is not really a true Islamic state. Okay? The closest thing to Islamic teachings are the principles found in the founding documents of our forefathers, which we are not following also many of them today, so that's a different story.
And I would expect nothing less to come from somebody who's affiliated with the Libertarian Party. So I wasn't going to go there, but now another question just popped into my head, and I hope there's a way that you can answer this in some short manner. I think a lot of people associate with some of the more, I want to say, fear-mongering parts of our political machinery and our media, mainstream media, is that this talk of the institution of Sharia law. I admit to being ignorant to the concept, And maybe is that in is are those tenets of Islam, or is that something totally different?
Well, the term Sharia law is similar to the term fatwa, is similar to the term Islamist, similar to many so-called sexy terminology that media can use and summarize and keep on the demonization and vilification of the other, the enemy that we would like to attack. Sharia law, or the word Sharia, the literal Arabic, the root of it means the way. So basically, Islam, the teachings of Islam, is like the user manual for Muslims to live by. You see? So Sharia is the way, and law was added later on just to make it more palatable to people to understand. But the sources of Islamic teachings or Islamic law, whichever word you like to use, are found in two things only. The Quran, which is, we believe it's the word of God, unchanged, untouched since it was revealed, and the example of Prophet Muhammad, whatever he said, whatever he did, whatever he accepted from previous cultures and religions. So those are the two sources, and that's where Islamic teachings or Islamic law comes from. We have in the Jewish tradition, in the Jewish religion, the halakha law, or as in English they say, the law. In Christianity, you follow also the Ten Commandments and other, I forgot the name in the Catholic Church, what they use for it, but it's very, very similar to that. So there's nothing alien about it. It does not contradict the founding documents. The unfortunate fear-mongering against it is part of the overall campaign that intensified after 9/11 in order to pave the way to have the support of the public opinion backing the government action in the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, and droning the heck out of a few countries in the Middle East and Southeast Asia. And, you know, if you do that, if you keep telling someone, point your finger at someone saying, this guy or this gal wants to attack you, they hate you, they want to kill you, you will, you know, want to naturally protect yourself. So in order for the government to do that, they keep pointing the finger at that other, and we know for a fact now that over a period of 8 years, there has been $42 million spent in what is called the Islamophobia industry. So those sexy terms came out during that time to vilify anything Islam and Muslim, and unfortunately, people have lives, they have bills to pay, they have work, they have children, so they don't have the time or even maybe the desire to invest into studying that thing for themselves. They hear from the media, they hear from the government, and they take it as it is. And, I mean, in a way, you can't blame many of them, but we can have a line in the sand with those who actually take it matters into their hands and start doing hate crimes against Muslims and those who look like Muslims, like the Sikh community, who is an Indian religious group, is not Muslim. Anyway, I can blab forever, so I'm going to get a chance to...
No, that's quite all right. I took you there. So getting back to that last question I asked you, and I just want to tell my listeners, we are going now into the kind of the meat of the topic for tonight, which is, and let me start by saying what it's not. What I don't want this to be is who's right, who's wrong, which side is right on their side, which side is being mean. What we're really wanting to get after tonight is the way that this conflict is being reported in the mainstream media here in the U.S., and is there a bias involved? And if there's a bias involved, what is that then doing? How does that flow down into the conversations that we have in our coffee houses and in our streets and around the water coolers at work about this horrible, you know, thing that's going on in the Middle East. And that's really what I want to keep this to. So again, I want to hear your opinions. I've got a genuine expert on multiple faiths here, a very learned man as our guest. And, you know, call in, ask questions, share your opinions with us. Let us know what you think. That's at 646-929-2495. And then just hit 1, and you can get into the conversation. But at this point, what I want to do is I really want to, going back to that last question I asked you about, here we have in the United States this codification of separation of church and state. But when you talk about Israel and you talk about Palestine, that line often seems blurred. So I guess it's a two-part question. And first of all, do you see those states as being more entwined with religion? Or is that really just a myth?
It is a myth, but over 100 years, it has been planted into the hearts and minds as a religious conflict. And I'm telling you, hearts and minds outside of Palestine. I was, over the past 2 weeks, of course, I've been searching into this more because of the recent violence over there. So I stumbled on YouTube upon a video from the late leader of Hamas, whose name is Ahmed Yassin, the quadriplegic leader of Hamas, who was assassinated by Israel. So he was saying, we do not hate the Jews. I have a house in Ashkelon, a house and land. I was forced out of this house and this land many years ago. I just want to get back to my house, kick out the one who kicked me out of my house, and take it back. It's like a three-minute YouTube video. If you search on YouTube, you'll find it, and you can see his own statement. And he was killed maybe 6, 7, 8 years ago. So, I mean, that's really old, before any of the recent few years spike in violence. But let's have some background to this issue. And let's take at face value, let's accept, for argument's sake, the decision of the United Nations to divide Palestine into two countries, one to become Israel and one to remain the other part for Palestine. 56% of Palestine was given by that decision to create the State of Israel at that time in 1947. A series of wars took place. Yes, the Arabs refused this decision. Yes, they came with their armies. But does that mean if you push back those armies outside of the borders that the UN decided, does that mean you take more land? That's exactly what happened. Israel kept taking land over years, including in 1967, where it took the entire Sinai Peninsula from Egypt, the Golan Heights from Syria, some parts of southern Lebanon, and a small piece of Jordan, if I remember correctly. When Egypt signed the peace accord with Israel in 1978, by the year 1982, Sinai, the peninsula, returned to Egypt. Right now, Israel returned almost all the land from southern Lebanon. There is a small piece that is still in dispute. The Golan Heights of Syria are still occupied, and I don't think there is any land from Jordan is occupied. The area of land, which is the 44% that the UN left for Palestine, is now only 22%. That's where the Palestinians, the original inhabitants of that area, plus those who were pushed out, basically, and it's a controversial term, but it is what took place in my opinion and many other, including Israeli historians and whatnot, there has been a systematic, incremental ethnic cleansing of those villages and towns, that to the fact that 80% of Palestinians in Gaza are actually refugees from other parts of Palestine. So we have 1.8 million Palestinians in Gaza, in a sliver of land that is like 25 miles long and 6 miles wide, living for the past 8 years under siege. There is no potable water. There is almost no electricity for long parts of the day. They cannot go to work. Half of the population is under 15 years old. And every couple of years, they keep on getting bombarded. And in the last 10, 11, 12 days, 550 of them were killed, civilians, not even the fighters, by Israeli tanks and F-16 jets firing missiles into their homes. And even the hospital today was hit by a tank shell, killing 5 people, including 2 in the intensive care unit. So, I mean, we have to have this background in mind when we talk. This didn't start 2 weeks ago. This started by the occupation. So unless we deal with the issue of the occupation, this will never be solved. I want to stop to give you a chance to have a...
No, that's quite all right. And, yeah, I just want to take, again, a quick chance. I see a lot of people hovering around the phone that are listening, but I haven't seen any hands raised. So, again, if you want to get in on the conversation, go ahead and dial in 646-929-2495, or for those of you who are already on hold, go ahead and press 1 and we can get into the conversation. Now, again, I'm trying not to take this down that rabbit trail of who's right, who's wrong. I was listening to what you were saying, and I will just simply say that, like, for instance, you talked about in 1967 that there was a land grab by Israel, in essence. When you listen to the other side of the story, it was the Six Days War, where all of the surrounding neighbors of Israel pointed guns at them and said, "We're going to get you." And then Israel, of course, did their, you know, sneak attack on the Air Force bases and grounded the air forces of Egypt and Syria, and that was that. But it's when you listen to the other side, it's, hey, it comes across that the story you're telling comes across as, and again, if you listen to the other side, it's like President Clinton said this great story about Kosovo. He said, Kosovo's whining and complaining that we're bombing them and going to get Milosevic. But he said, that's like a little kid who comes home all beat up from school, and mother says, "What happened?" And the kid says, "Well, it all started when the other kid hit me back."
Okay. So I
And this is the media kind of, that's the story I think, I believe that's the story that we hear more often in this country than the one you told. And I'm not saying which one's wrong and which one's right, because I wasn't there. But we know the Six Days War did exist. We know that some of the countries have been saying ever since Israel got there, "We really don't want you here. You're going to have to leave, or we're going to annihilate you." So mm-hmm. So how do you juxtapose the two stories without having it just go right down to, okay, well, we're just not going to agree, so I'm going to go back to my camp and grab my RPG, and you grab yours, and let's go.
A very fair question. And I had said that let's take it at face value, and let's accept for argument's sake that the Arab armies invaded Israel. Let's take that without argument. My opinion, that's not the way it happened. But let's take it at face value and accept it for argument's sake. Now what? After you repelled those armies, why did you take the land that does not belong to you? Why do you still today, after 45 years since 67, have Gaza under siege, have the West Bank semi-quasi-control over it? Palestinians have no airport, have no army, have no navy, have no air force, have no self-determination, have no country. So I keep getting asked, and by the way, when I'm talking, I'm not talking from confrontational way. I'm trying to find a solution. I'm trying to reach the bottom, the root of cause of the problem, which is, in my opinion, is the occupation of the Palestinian land. I get the question sometimes, do you accept the right of Israel to exist? In the beginning, I didn't know what to say. But now I'm thinking about it. 45 years since 67 alone, forget even 1948, Israel does exist. Clearly, Israel has enough power to impose its existence. The question here is not if Israel exists. The question is, does Israel accept the right of Palestine to exist? And does Israel, the government, I mean talking government here, do they accept that the Palestinian individual is a human being of equal worth and value to their citizens? This is the problem that we're having. Whenever you talk about this issue, you get bombarded. You're anti-Semitic. You don't want Israel to exist. No, no, no. Let's put this aside. Let's look at the facts on the ground. Since 1948, Israel exists. That's a fact of life. Palestine does not have sovereignty today. So basically, it does not exist today. Does Israel accept the right of Palestine to exist? Are Palestinians people, human beings, of equal worth and value, just like any other human being? Are we going to uphold, as Americans, our values that all men are created equal?
Was that a question?
I mean, it's kind of a question. I hope the callers would try to engage in answering that, but to me it's kind of rhetorical, you know. I mean, it should be. But hopefully in the next few days and weeks we'll see development towards ceasefire and then addressing the root cause of the problem.
Right. And I think this good news, we got some callers that are chiming in now that want to answer your question. But I think we're getting to the heart of the matter. I think for us here in America, halfway around the world, we hear different stories, conflicting stories, and the question is, are we getting the truth? And unfortunately, with our media, you never know, right? But I think you and I have actually framed this very nicely in, you know, you're saying you accept this fact, and I'm saying what I believe is what I've been told. And this is the thing. So what I want to do is I want to go to 850. I'm going to open up your mic. 850, who do we have the pleasure of speaking with?
Yeah, my Kirk. We chatted a little bit last week on energy, et cetera. And, you know, it all, from my point of view, boils down to, you know, whoever's perspective. You got governments, you got individuals, and you have this gentleman who sounds extremely well, intentioned, but, you know, look, all you got to do is go back in history and you can see, you know, are you the policeman? Are you the policeman? Who's the person that's going to take charge of giving the people their rights ultimately? And the reason things are going down the tubes consistently in various places around the world is because people don't have the ability to create their own revolution like we did here and then back it up with, you know, France or whoever to give them the rights by the, you know, by sword, by gun, by bomb, whatever. So they're trying to do it, you know, with their rockets, and they go overboard, and the Israelis want to say, no, we deserve our peace and quiet. And so, I mean, we're not the best examples of, you know, how to go about doing it sometimes, which is why I basically get into the renewable energy field and offer a job to everybody, basically. And if you can cross the barriers where there is no sides, everybody has respect of themselves and their position in their communities by having a sustainable place for them to grow and to, you know, create that atmosphere that you can work in where you have the opportunities that everybody deserves. And to get to that point, this is why you're talking. This is why he's, you know, trying to create a dialogue, and then you're trying to facilitate it, which is makes perfect sense. But it's too broad a question to narrow down into one conversation, I don't believe, because it's so convoluted and everybody has their own picture of what the truth is. So,
well, okay, Kirk, so let me stop you there, because so let me ask you this very straight, because that's exactly what we want to focus on, not the right or the wrongs or the justice. Let me ask you this question. Where do you get, if you don't mind me asking, if you don't mind telling us, what news outlets do you, where do you get your media from?
Well, I mean, I got to say, I don't pay a lot of attention to any of it, you know, if I catch it on the news, but years of, you know, paying attention to all the various news sources, every news, you know, whatever is around. I don't actually have a TV. I don't pay much attention. I work. But I hear what's going on, and I've known the history of Israel and Palestine and the various Syrias and the Egypt. I mean, it's not a new topic. It's a new era of how much can you tolerate? How much, you know, who's going to step in and say enough is enough? The best thing that ever started to happen was when they started to do the exchange programs between, you know, the countries where they had, you know, soccer players or whatever it was, you know, cultural stuff. But, you know, everything escalates and then you have the tolerance levels for the danger levels and watching the Russians decide they can do this. There's a lot of distractions that allow people to pull triggers and move in directions that they may not normally have gone, by the fact that they see everything so volatile, and who's going to pick up the stick and say, no, you can't do that, and slap anybody down right now. There's too much going on, so people take liberties, and the diplomacy part of it is taking a back seat, unfortunately.
You sound a little bit frustrated, Kirk. Let's see if Hamas has some answers for you.
Sure. So you had me when you said you don't own a TV. I thank you and I applaud you and I love you for that. I can't escape from it. I want to, but I can't. TV, unfortunately, and cable, especially cable news, is poison. Let me give you an example. CNN yesterday, you know, yesterday was a bloody massacre in that neighborhood in the city of Gaza. 87 Palestinian civilians dead, okay? From shelling, whether it's tank shelling or F-16 jets missiles. Now, the headline in CNN says, and this is the CNN online, Hamas, semicolon, Israeli soldier captured. So Hamas is saying they captured an Israeli soldier. That's the headline. Down there in the fine print, if you will, Gaza's battle's deadliest day, the Gaza Health Ministry said 87 Palestinians died on Sunday. Yeah, they got a heart attack and died, all 87 of them? You see what I mean by the media and the wording and the messaging? How is it skewed towards showing who has more value than the other? It's not even, I'm not even talking about neutral. The headline in bold, large font, Israeli soldier captured. And down in the story, 87 Palestinians died. How did they die? And that's just an example of how the media portrays this conflict.
No, and that is what has a lot of people up in arms. And it's almost as if it's like the media thinks they're doing a favor for Israel, like a PR job. But in essence, let me ask you this question, and then we're going to bring in our next caller. It's actually our mutual friend Bobby, and then 678, we're going to come to you after that. But let me ask you this question. So we hear this news, you know, you watch this news on cable, and like Kirk, I don't own cable. I have a television, but I do Netflix and Hulu, so I use my television to escape reality. But how much of this is just futile because of the advent of social media? Because somebody can click a picture and Instagram it or put it on Facebook, And instantly, any kind of cover-up that's being done by the media is known to be just that.
As a matter of fact, I'm glad you brought this up, because social media in this particular latest flare of violence, I want to call it by a different name, but let's be neutral for the sake of having a peaceful conversation. Social media was crucial in exposing what really happened, the massacres that took place in Gaza over the past few nights. But let's look at reporters. Ayman Wahiddin, who is the reporter from NBC, after reporting on the four Palestinian kids who were playing soccer on the beach and got shelled from the Israeli Navy and died, he was yanked out of Gaza. And because of an uproar in social media, Twitter, Facebook, whatnot, NBC was forced to return Ayman Wahiddin to report again from Gaza. Now, CNN, one of her reporters, I forgot her name, she was on a roof, a hilltop, somewhere, I think in Ashkelon, where some Israelis sitting and watching the bombardment of Gaza, and when a missile hits or some sort of an explosion happened, they cheer and clap. So she tweeted a picture of them, and at the end saying, scum, because, I mean, basically they are cheering on human suffering and people are dying and whatnot. She was yanked out of Gaza as well. I don't know if she's going to return back or not, but those are two examples of how social media was crucial in showing the reality on the ground of what is really happening and the impact of such brutal tactics by the Israeli military.
Yep, I totally agree. And that's, you know, that goes back to the Coffee Party's mission. One of our missions is to create citizen journalists. And let's face it, ever since we all saw Rodney King laying face down, getting beaten by eight cops, saying, you know, just please stop. I think we've learned that lesson that, you know, that everybody at any one time, we all have smartphones, or most of us have smartphones with cameras. And, you know, the hope is that people will behave better, right? I think there's a saying that says character, your true character is shown by what you do when no one's looking. And yeah. I think people have to come to the realization that everybody's looking at everybody else all the time, and you're not going to be able to get away with much if you think you are. But with that, Kirk, thank you so much for the call. I want to bring in our mutual friend here, Bobby Rodrigo, 678. We're coming to you right after this, but I want to bring Bobby in here and start by thanking you. This has already been a wonderful 45 minutes of radio, and I have you to thank for it. So thank you, Bobby. How are you tonight?
I'm great. Good evening, gentlemen, and good evening, Coffee Party audience. It's nice to say hello this evening, and I'm glad the subject is being talked about.
Thank you, Bobby.
You know, you just mentioned the Rodney King thing, and it made me run off a little bit on a tangent mentally. It's interesting how social media, without question, the two examples that were just talked about were very impactful, from social media causing those changes. I actually posted a picture during these last couple of weeks of a picture of Israeli citizens writing their names or writing something on missiles before they were fired. It was insane. From the standpoint of Rodney King that you mentioned, one of the things that always disturbed me about the Rodney King video was if you put it in front of 10 people, you might get five different versions of what they're looking at. And to me, there was never an argument or a debate about what you saw. You know, and yet that's how that verdict happened, if you think about it, back then. So as much as social media is able to impact certain things, we still spend a lot of time vetting the truth to come out. One of the things that has happened in this particular, in the instances that you guys were just talking about, is that the people who knew the truth, that made the decisions, needed to react. But that doesn't happen all the time with our general public, unfortunately. But I of course, I want to stay on point to what you were talking about. One of the things that disturbs me so much about what's going on, especially from the standpoint of the discussions that are going on in this country, regardless of the media, is we have a government that is based upon documents that claim that we are all endowed with the same rights by our creator, whoever the creator may be, maker or whatever. John Adams had a beautiful speech when he was talking about liberty will reign when he was first asked to represent Massachusetts, for example. I think it was 1775. What we have had a history in this country of doing the exact opposite. And, of course, the first thing that comes to mind is black slavery. But it's been beyond that. I mean, we know about laws that were actually created by our government that, attacked the Chinese. Laws that were created at the turn of the 1900s where they had a rating system, essentially, on immigrants that were coming in. The Nordics were better classified than the non-Nordics. You know, we had a concentration camps, which is so important. As you all know, I work about the NDAA law, and we had concentration camps with the Japanese people in 1942. We have continually rated ethnicities in this world. And to me, one of the things that's going on here is that's exactly what we're doing. Listen, I Hashem, for example, knows a lot more about what Hamas is about, or what the on-the-ground real-life issues are, I believe. My situation is if I accept Hamas as being the evil whatever, I still am looking at the 11th rated most powerful military in the world, as Hashem pointed out, with the Army, Air Force, et cetera. Basically, having a policy that allows them to kill civilians. I don't care if they send a message, please leave your house. Their military tactic is to kill civilians. And for us to be debating the merits of that, to me, is insane from a human rights standpoint, period.
Well, hold on a second, because I don't think anybody's debating it. I don't think that anybody on this call, hopefully nobody who is listening to my voice, believes for a half a second that any killing of innocent civilians, whether even accidental, but let alone on purpose, would be acceptable. I don't think there's anybody on. I hope there's nobody listening that thinks that.
Not on this call. In the narrative that is being spoken, look at the resolution that was passed by the Senate, 100-0. Look at the wording of the resolution. Everything that comes out of the rhetoric or the debates from the human rights discussion is Israel has a right to defend. Of course they have a right to defend themselves. If they're being attacked, they have a right to defend themselves. Anybody who's being attacked, any country that's being attacked has a right to defend themselves, without getting into the specifics of the problem. But Israel's tactics, literally their tactic, is to fire on civilians, on the civilian population. And the excuse is, as well, Hamas is using humans as shields. That's not good enough. There is no military.
Bobby, I heard you saying, but hold on a second, Bobby. This is what I was trying to avoid, going down this rabbit trail, because I know where this is going. I know my Bobby Rodrigo well enough to know that the next thing he's going to talk about is how is the U.S. drone strikes and how we do it too.
No, I'm talking about the media. This is a media.
Well, okay.
This is how the media narrative is creating the debate in our society and has been for years, in my view. Okay, forget the liberty issues of any other subject. This is a human rights issue, period. For this country, forget the world's response. This country is where we are. And this is the media narrative that is being – and when you have a discussion, go on social media and find a discussion. And this is the narrative that will happen. When you tell them that Israel should not be killing civilians, they will not even pay attention to that part of the discussion based upon the narrative media. That's all I'm saying.
All right. Well, so hang on.
It's grossly improper in this country, I believe.
All right. So hang on. So because I want to ask Kamash a very pointed question based on what you just said. So what you were just talking about was, to me, it boils down to this concept of this divisive mentality of right and wrong, and the way we're going to adjudicate this is through violent conversation or violent behavior. Hamash, do you see a difference, and then I'm going to ask you a follow-up question on this. Do you see a difference in the way America acts these days? Am I seeing this wrong, or are we quicker to just go to, let's drop, you know, in hockey terms, let's drop the gloves and fight?
So it is unfortunate that there is an unbalanced influence from the Israeli lobby over our decision makers and lawmakers, and therefore even senators who claim to be libertarian, even senators who claim to be socialist, voted for that resolution. And I second what Bobby said. Go and read the language of the resolution. It's a one-sided carte blanche to Israel. Defend yourself. Nobody is arguing with defending yourself. You don't need a resolution to defend yourself. That's just a...
Okay, but outside of the government and the way the government acts, because... frankly, I don't trust anything inside the Beltway to be correct or ethical in any way, shape, or form. I'm talking about on the streets, around the water coolers, regular citizens talking to each other, engaging in these discussions. How poisoned have we become by the media how primed are we just to fight? Let's just fight about it. Let's not have a rational discussion. Let's just fight.
Sure. That's an excellent question. The problem is, which you alluded to earlier, that the American public have been exposed to only one narrative, one side of the story, for generations. They do not get the reality that we are talking about now on the ground, that the social media also helped expose. So when they keep hearing Israel is defending themselves, and a headline, instead of 87 civilian Palestinians killed from shelling, the headline is an Israeli soldier captured by Hamas. It intensifies and perpetuates the image of that other is a savage. He wants to kill you. We're keeping you safe from them. They're doing your bidding, so support them. This is the unfortunate reality of what happened. Unless the person knows someone from the area or someone who has good knowledge about it, and they get to listen, because even if you know somebody, they might not listen to you. But if they actually listen and investigate on their own, they would realize the unbalanced approach to this issue from the media and also, of course, the government.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that we are constantly pushing here at Coffee Party, is for people to just don't accept the first soundbite that comes off the radio or off the television. Go do your investigation. Get your own set of sources that you believe are neutral or as neutral as possible, and investigate, right? Because I think, as you mentioned near the beginning of the show, there's so many people in this country who just, and honestly, I think you're a lot nicer than I am about it. I just think it's laziness, is that they just grab onto a soundbite and repeat it. I mean, how many times have you been in a conversation and you know you're talking to Rush Limbaugh? I mean, because people will just repeat his words, all like verbatim. And you go, wait a second, have you ever thought about this for yourself?
But this is part of psychology, unfortunately. They mastered this science of the soundbite messaging, branding, marketing technique. So they send you the message in a nutshell and send you back to the commercial so you can wait for your check to buy that new thing and whatever. It's an unfortunate reality, and very few people have the ability to, like, be resilient against such things. And I mean, the first thing I would recommend is just cancel cable. Do your own research. Go to the library, you know.
I think that's a wonderful idea. Now, I want to ask you a follow-up question. that I think is that to me is tremendously important. So I was reading through your very lengthy resume, and I noticed that one of the things you're involved in is that you offer educational opportunities within the New York City schools.
No, I get invited to lectures in different places. Sometimes it is in schools, and sometimes I actually give a class at St. John's here University in New York once a semester. I get invited by the professor, who's a friend of mine, retired priest, to give the class about Islamic religion, like a crash course on Islam.
So when you do that, what I'm really interested in knowing is, I see how the adults of our time, us primarily, people, our peers, often act as children or animals, worse yet, animals in these instances. What, give me some hope that the younger generation is going to be somehow different. Can you give me some hope for that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is the generation, two things happened to this generation. One, they grew up, many of them, with different people from different walks of life and different parts of the world. So that's a little different than, like, let's say, 50, 60 years ago. Also, this is the generation of social media. They don't get their news from CNN and Fox. They get it from Twitter and Instagram, and sometimes John Stewart, you know. So it's a sad reality when we take our comedy shows serious and our news shows not serious. But this generation has a better chance because of their interaction with others, not only from the Muslim world, but from all over the world. So they are more open, tolerant of others.
And I think that tolerance comes from understanding and an actual desire to understand instead of a desire to judge, which I think our generation is. We just became way too judgmental, right? And again, based on what little facts or what facts we were getting, which rounds it back out. So I really appreciate that. I feel good knowing that these younger people are going to come up and not make the same mistakes we did. I want to bring in 678. You've been patiently holding. Thank you very much. Who do we have the pleasure of speaking with?
Hello, how are you? This is Q calling from Atlanta. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Good, good. Did you say Hugh?
Q.
Q. Okay, Q. And you have some comments on the media, on any kind of media bias you've been seeing, or do you want to ask our guest a question? What can we do for you?
Quick comment. Not so much media, because I think that's just a futile, endless merry-go-round. Until we put some parental stickers, like we did in music, on what gets broadcast and why. Until we're able to put parental stickers that says in big, bold letters, blind opinion, or just factless opinion, or just opinion, then I think we'll always have this problem, because these news medias have one sliver of news and the rest of it's just somebody's "I woke up in the morning" opinion. So I really don't want to speak on that one. The thing I will speak on is this, on international affairs. As far as the Muslims are concerned, let me just say this. I'm glad that the new people teaching the Quran are a little bit more articulate in how to present it in a peaceful manner. When I was young, I used to see people come from other countries always be angry about something. So that appeared to be a turnoff for me. Now, having traveled and having interacted with some people, I come to find out here and there's different factions of Muslims, like there are Crips and Bloods. That's how I look at it. But with that said, the thing with Israel is very disappointing, because I don't care about these agreements and all that, but one thing I care about is that 1946 map. When I look at that 1946 map, I see Israel was given a piece of land off in the corner of Palestine. And if it were not for the money that's generated from family and friends over in America, sending back over to Israel, Israel would not now have transformed that map into what the 2014 map it is now, giving Palestine a little sliver of land. That's disrespectful. I look at Israel as bloodthirsty people. When Obama came president, let me finish, please. When Obama came president, all I heard on the very first day was nigger, nigger, nigger on YouTube in Israel, on the Israel streets. This person never did nothing to him. This person's never even said nothing bad about him.
Again, we're going down a rabbit trail. I don't want to go, and it's just gotten a lot worse. That's what we're going to talk about.
Media is evil. Okay, I'll stick to the media since you want to marginalize that. The media is evil.
I don't want to marginalize anything. I want to maintain A, what the topic of the conversation is supposed to be, and I want to make sure that people aren't throwing hate bombs in for no apparent reason. There was absolutely no reason for you to bring up what you allegedly saw that I never heard anybody but you just say what you just said about what they heard about Israel, and it's not appreciated on the show. That's all. So I just appreciate if you could stick to the topic.
The topic is supposed to be about Israel and Palestine. Am I correct?
No, it's supposed to be about, is there media bias in the way that the Israeli-Palestine conflict is being reported, and how does that affect the conversation on Main Street?
Okay. My apologies. Is there media bias? Of course there is, because we're in America is in Israel's back pocket. Israel can do anything that they wish to do, and America has to obey. So as long as we have
why would you say that? What leverage does Israel have over the United States that they can dominate the most powerful people in the world?
It is my belief that with family, friends, lineage, and all that type of stuff in power here in America, whether it be political, entertainment, what have you, and that connection back to the homeland, Italians have it, Chinese have it, Asians, Japanese have it.
Okay, and thank you very much for your call, Q. I apologize to my listeners. I probably let that go on a little bit too long. Just so you know, if you look at the Jewish population, it's 1%. There's 5 million Jews, approximately 540 million Jews living in 5,400,000 Jews living in the United States. It's about 1% of the population. I don't think that's the 1 or 2% that we're having trouble with. But Hamas, tell me something. If you were in my position, Is there anything you can say to Q to get him off his belief set? I'm at a loss.
Benny, I love you. Did you just call me Hamas? It's Hisham.
Oh, my gosh. I am so sorry.
That's okay.
That's because I wrote it wrong on the board.
No problem.
I'm sorry, Hisham.
No, that's fine. That's fine. And the joke is actually my name is very close to the name of God in Hebrew, Hashem. So I always joke with my friends who are rabbis. My name is Hisham, not Hashem. I don't need any trouble with God. So that's just a side joke. Now, the influence that Israel wields over U.S. politics is documented. The Israeli lobby, that is known as AIPAC, is very influential within Congress. They have so much power to the effect that, again, even the socialist Senator Bernie Sanders voted for that resolution in the Senate, which is an absolute carte blanche one side in support of Israel and didn't even, you know, in disregard to the human life that is being lost by the hundreds over there in that area of the world. There are American organizations that work on this and document these things. For example, the Council for the National Interest, who's headed by a former CIA officer, Jewish Voices for Peace, Jews Against Islamophobia. Those are American Jews who see this unbalance in the approach to this issue and try to reach a just solution. You see, the question here is we should achieve a just solution, not just a solution. And that's a good way to talk about the ceasefire issue that we keep hearing about. The new government in Egypt, and I am of Egyptian origin, has very antagonistic relationship to Hamas, who's controlling Gaza. They did not even talk with Hamas before they offered this ceasefire resolution. They offered it to Israel and then announced it without consulting with Hamas. And even if we put that insult aside, the conditions of that ceasefire agreement did not even talk about lifting the siege over 1.8 million people in Gaza who don't have potable water, who don't have electricity for much of the day, who cannot get building supplies, who cannot get food from the borders of Israel or Egypt, under siege for 8 years, very little that goes through. So even that ceasefire agreement didn't amount to lifting the suffering of those people. So that's where Hamas, and rightfully so in this one, refused that ceasefire. So let's talk about the solution. I mean, we keep talking about the problem, but we never get to actually, and then what? What are we going to do? When would Israel accept to withdraw from the occupied lands? And today, I saw Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, who was the nominee for president. He ran for president of the Palestinian Authority last time against Mahmoud Abbas. So he said he knows for a fact, because he was doing those negotiations, that Hamas and every other Palestinian faction is ready, as long as Israel withdraws from the occupied land, stops the attacks, the shelling and whatnot, that they are ready to accept a two-state solution with peace and just moving on. Why is Israel refusing to do that? 45 years.
Well, but see, and again, we're getting we're getting into this right versus wrong thing, because again, somebody on the other side of that argument would say, but in 2002 in the peace initiative, they agreed. They said, we'll give you back the land. We just want you to acknowledge and accept our right to exist. And Arafat said no. So again, we can go back and forth and back and forth, and there's probably, look, you know how this goes, right? Because look, and this is, now I want to talk to the interfaith mediator person who's done all this coalition and bridge building and whatnot. You know as well as I do that when the two brothers have a fight and they come to dad and they each tell their side of the story, there's one side of the story, there's another guy's side of the story, and then somewhere in the middle is the truth, right? So if we accept that, how do we, as Americans, help resolve the situation?
Okay. We can start by not supporting one side over the other. We should be actually neutral. Okay? So we give Israel $3 billion in weapons every year. Zero for the Palestinians. I mean, it's not that I want to give weapons to the Palestinians. I just don't want to fuel more of the fighting. That's the point. If we actually,
yeah, but hold on, but isn't it? But I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there. But isn't it true that Israel has the capacity, from a military standpoint, to destroy Palestine utterly 100,000 times over? Why do they need more weapons? Why would more weapons, how does that make any difference?
Well, I thank you for raising the question. I wish somebody in the government here or there answer. I mean, they have more firepower than the Arab world combined. So, I mean, that's a question for them to answer, and hopefully we can get that discussion going. But as far as us, as Americans, we need to raise awareness that the current situation cannot continue because, I mean, let's assume, and I know this will sound bad, but let's assume that the people in Gaza are actually dogs, not human beings. You have 1.8 million dogs in Gaza. Imagine what the world will do if, you know, if the treatment of dogs in Gaza like the treatment of human beings right now. Remember that we created hell over two statues in Afghanistan when the Taliban brought them down. I mean, we raise hell about a lot of things, but when it comes to the Palestinian people, there is some weird, I don't know what happens, but we don't look at them as equal, of equal worth and value because, and here's the thing, here's the impact of the media and the vilification of the other. Palestinians altogether are lumped as Hamas, as terrorists. That's the problem that we have in the discourse, and this is, I think, what Bobby was trying to allude to. We don't separate between extremists and civilians. We have more than 500 civilians dead in the last 10 days. I mean, how many more would it take for us to realize that we need to be neutral and not support one side over the other? And from a libertarian liberty standpoint, we deserve as Americans this money more than anyone else in the world. Let's give it to Detroit, for God's sake. You know, Detroit can use $3 billion, not in weapons, but in infrastructure.
Well, you say weapons, other people say foreign aid, but I would also point out the fact that we transact over $3 billion in import-export with Israel every month. So obviously one of the things that at least our leaders are protecting are the markets that are, you know, that are fueled by these good trading partners. If Palestine had, you know, if we were doing that kind of trade with them, boy, you know what, I'd better be a different story.
Well, I mean, the free market and the trade, free trade is the key basis of the solution. I mean, Palestinians, where will they work? Yes, there is much work needed to build up what has been demolished in Palestine, but Israeli economy can use many of the Palestinian labor force. So free trades and you know, a free economy would be a key base, solution for the conflict over there, but we need to stop fueling because that's what's happening, unfortunately. We have a hand in this. We keep fueling this conflict by supporting one side over the other, including with weapons. By the way, and let's not, I mean, I'm not biased. Egypt is the second highest recipient of foreign aid from the United States. And that too, I mean, where does it go? It goes to a few corrupt generals on the top. 2.1 billion of them are weapons. How those weapons are used against the Egyptian population? You know?
Well, if my good friend Janine Loudon were here, she would say that is our government driving the profiteering of the arms manufacturers, as it always has, as it did in World War II, as it's done on every conflict. And just making sure, look, yeah, we see, well, look, we can give weapons to each of them. I mean, that's the oldest story in the book, right? It just fueled the conflict. I mean, but here's the thing. I don't want to make this centric about our government. I'd rather make it centered on the people, because in the end, just like it is that if we're going to overcome the influence of money in government, if we're going to have a fair tax code, if we're going to make sure that government's aim is to put people back to work one way or another,
It's going to come from us because the people in Washington just don't listen to us anymore. And with that, I have another caller I want to bring in. We have a new caller. It's area code 508. Area code 508, who do we have the pleasure of speaking to?
Yes, hi. It's Keon from Boston.
Keon from Boston. How are you this evening, sir?
Good, thank you. Very nice conversation here you guys having. I just wanted to add to it that the bias in the media in the U.S. is one of the reasons that, you know, more people are not outraged of what's going on in Palestine and Israel. Because, you know, it's one-sided, basically, the media in the U.S. It's all for Israel, and they don't say all the atrocities that are happening to their kids in civilians and kids in Palestine, and there's no reporting, basically. But if it was anywhere else, if, let's say, Iran was doing that, or it was 100 Jewish kids dying, what would happen? Just think about it. And also,
But in all fairness, during the height of the Syrian civil war, when they had those horrible gas attacks, those images were all over American media. But I hear what you're saying, and I'm not disagreeing, right? And I think it comes back to the social media really tells the story. Bobby sent to me earlier today a pictorial, it was not really an article, it was just a series of pictures that showed it. And that's the thing, is that the media can block it out. The mainstream media can block it out, but those of us who are interested in getting it, we can get it, and we must get it. But here's my question again. If we can manage to get out of this who's right and who's wrong and just go, these are human beings, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, anatomically speaking, from the most different looking people in the world, we are still 99.9% the same and 1% different, or 0.1% different. Why can't we look at this, you know, and see these are people that who wants this to happen to anyone? Why can't we just stop looking at taking sides?
Exactly.
There you go, back to Rodney King.
Why can't we get along? I know, but, you know, the
problem... Sham, how do we make this a humanistic problem instead of a Jewish or Israeli or Palestinian problem?
Exactly. It shouldn't be the religious problem. It's a humanitarian problem. It's a human problem. I mean, you know,
right.
This has been going on for so long. You know, we have to do something about it. One-state solution or two-state solution. Anything except the status quo. That's what's going on. You know, it's just innocent people getting killed. And the problem is, you know, it's our tax dollars. That's why I feel guilty when I see these atrocities. This is my money. I pay about $20,000 a year in taxes, property taxes, income tax, all the taxes that I pay. I see the result. You know, $4 billion, $3 billion a year. Why? You know, that really frustrates me when I see my tax dollars going over there. That's the problem. I mean, you know, if it was Africa, I had nothing to do with it. It's not my money being to arms to them, you know. When it comes to Israel and Palestine, a lot of people are like, oh, why you don't care about Africa? I say, it's not my money. But over here, it's like $4 billion, $3 billion at least a year for past 40 years, I don't know, 50 years. A lot of money, and I feel
it absolutely is. But again, Keon, if we want to take this to the next level, and I really want to hear Hisham on this, because I think this is the key. If we stop just looking at sides of countries or organizations or sects, religion, whatever it is that divides us, and say, look, we're all human beings, and this is not good or healthy. As human beings, because let's face it, hold on a second, let's face it, we do this too, we, the United States. Your tax, more tax dollars go into the drone assassination program that is being carried out right now by the current administration. Way more money is going into the drone assassination program that goes to Israel and foreign aid. Why aren't we screaming to stop that?
Okay, let me tell you something. The problem is the same people that are controlling the media, I mean, basically the media is controlled by the corporations, they're the same people that don't want everybody to know about anything. That's what's going on.
So, yep.
Go ahead, Sean, please.
Thank you. So President Eisenhower, in his farewell address, warned us 40, 50 years ago about the military-industrial complex. Unfortunately, as the gentleman who was just talking mentioned, the same corporations who benefit from those conflicts are the ones who are in control of the media, are the ones who sell us most of our goods. So their advertisements are the money that fuels the work, the daily work of the networks, and some of those corporations write on the networks directly. Like GE used to own NBC until they sold it to someone else recently. So NBC, leading up to and during the war on Iraq, the latest one, how would NBC put an opposition to the war or even a balanced view of the war when GE has a $1 billion contract in Iraq? You see where it comes? So it comes also again to the control of those corporations and the military-industrial complex. But what can we do about it? Well, to me, and especially being in the political field, I learned the hard way that your local organizing, your local vote is much more worth than your national vote, including for president. You have a say in the local, scene than the national one. But you can inundate each and every one of us, can take a few minutes and write a letter to our four federal elected officials, our congressmen, the two states, U.S. senators from the state, and the president, even if it's the same letter, but just change the name and the address of the recipient. I oppose this policy of sending money overseas, for example. And it doesn't need to be an essay, just your position on something. The more those offices of those elected officials get those letters, faxes, emails, and phone calls, they record pro or con that issue. And it does make a difference if they get inundated. Email inboxes are full. If their fax runs out of paper, if they have boxes of letters that is impeding traffic inside the office, they will pay attention. And that's what we can do. And of course, even though I have little belief or confidence in the voting system, but still, let's not give them the ability to claim to represent us without us participating. So let's go out and let's vote. And the more important vote is the local vote, and then all the way up to the president.
That's beautiful. Think globally, act locally. That is awesome. We actually have a new caller. Welcome in, area code 661. Your mic is hot. Who do we have the pleasure of speaking with? Yeah, we get those every once in a while.
That was actually an Arabic song. I recognize it. I guess he forgot the stereo running.
Or maybe that was his music on hold. He put us on hold there for a second. I don't know.
Maybe.
It always comes back to me, and it's, you know, you had mentioned that we had mentioned a bunch of things that I had created questions for you in my head. Is there a way, or maybe better yet, is there value in forcing people to hold a mirror up to them and say, you know, what would you do, right? What would you do if you were in this position?
That's your own point. You're exactly right. Dear President Obama, despite any political difference between me and you, Malia and Sasha are the same age of 150 Palestinian kids that were killed over the past 10 days. What would you do if those were your kids? And, I mean, I'm hoping that the president and everyone else is human enough to realize and ask themselves that question.
So I agree with you, but with all due respect, are you telling me that in all of the suicide bombings that went on over the years, that there weren't Israeli kids killed? Americans, you know, Americans killed, tourists killed. I mean, it just sounded partisan the way it came out, that's all.
No, absolutely. I didn't even think about that. I'm just talking about this latest, rise in the violence and the attacks and whatnot. So I'm just trying to bring it to the mind, to the attention of the people, and putting the mirror, as you just mentioned, what if this was your kid on either side? It does not matter. As long as we are humans, and you said we're 99.9% the same, you know. The religious teachings, by the way, are also the same in this regard. The Quran mentions and quotes God is saying, as we wrote it before in the Torah, whoever kills a soul without a valid reason, and a valid reason is not up to individuals, it's as if they killed all humanity, and whoever saves a soul, as if they saved all humanity. In the Quran and in the Torah, the same exact concept. And the Torah, it's the Old Testament, so Christians also are included. So all the Abrahamic religions hold the sanctity of life the same. So there is no difference here also. It's political, and people who benefit from this, who wants to divide and conquer us, the human beings, and separate us from each other, are benefiting from this, are doing this bidding. And something very important I want to mention, and I'm glad I remembered, any country in the world is three parts. The land, the geography, the water, that's one part. The people or the population, that's the second part. And then the government. I doubt that a Palestinian person hates the hills of Ashkelon. Nobody will hate geography, God's, you know, green earth. So that's one. And my own belief, and that's why I'm in the interfaith world, that's why I'm trying to build bridges. My own belief is the absolute majority of people everywhere in the world are decent people who just want to live in peace and happiness. It's just those who are benefiting, i.e. the governments, and those who are behind the governments are dividing us and pitting us against each other. Nationalism is one of the worst diseases in the world. There were no passports 100 years ago. Did you know that? Passports did not come to exist until World War I. So, I mean, everybody was free to travel anywhere. So we are all the same. We might be a different color, have a different accent, eat differently, but we are here to get to know each other. And this is another verse in the Quran. We created you from a single male and a female so that you may know each other, not that you may despise each other. The most righteous amongst you are those who are most pious. And if you look at piety, I do not know what's inside your heart. You do not know what's inside my heart. I can talk forever, very good, but maybe I'm hiding something in my heart. So only God knows what's inside my heart and knows the level of true piety that I or you or anybody else has. So we should not judge each other. We should work with each other to benefit each other and, you know, build this land and live in peace.
So I agree wholeheartedly with that statement. I think it gives us a really excellent question to ponder as we move forward as the basis for any possible solution to this, and that is this. So you say we shouldn't judge each other. You know, you and I don't have a history, so I'm much more liable to give you a blank slate and to treat you like a blank slate than I would somebody I have known for 50 years. So on that, going down that path, given the length of this conflict, is it even a possibility, or no, forget it. I'm going to assume the positive. How do we get it? How do we get these people to sit down and somehow put all of their past behind them and say, okay, we're going to do a do-over. We're going to start now. Go. How do you get there?
Sure. What I told you that I heard today, I saw this guy, Mustafa Barghouti, on Fox News, out of all networks, by the way. I was surprised. And he was saying that all Palestinian factions are ready to have a two-state solution, stop the attacks from either side, and have a long-lasting, true, and just peace. And let's see what the response will be.
So just keep trying and trying and trying.
Yeah, I mean it's pushing. I mean it's even ridiculous to say pushing the patience, because since 1967, that's more than 46 years. I am 43 years old, so my same person who, if I was born in Gaza or the West Bank, I would have been living my 43 years under military occupation. So I guess enough. May God open our eyes and our hearts.
But I agree. And in those same years, well, no, that's not true. But prior to Israeli's occupation of the Golan Heights, if you lived in a kibbutz down below the Golan Heights, you just got used to people lobbing grenades down the hill onto you. This is what I'm saying. We have to somehow, I don't know, and I don't know how you get there again. I tell you what, obviously the media is not helping. I think it's Kirk have the right idea. I think you just got to turn it off. I think we somehow have to unplug from the mainstream media.
Yeah. So then, to balance that media bias, there is a very good documentary that was made called Occupation 101. I really suggest that the listeners give it, invest in it. It's like an hour and a half to see the story from the other side. Okay. Even assume it is biased. Let's even assume it is biased. But just have the other side of the story and then make up your own mind. So something to understand how Palestinians have been living and what would be the solution. And the solution is simple. Withdraw to the lands that was assigned to you. You have enough, I mean, as far as Israel, you have enough power, you have enough weapons, you have enough of everything to impose your existence and whatnot. Now is the time to resolve it. It's getting more than ugly now. Hopefully some people would listen.
I agree with you totally. I want to bring my benefactor, Bobby Rodrigo, back in for a final word here. Again, Bobby, thank you so much, and for bringing Hisham to the show. And Hisham, thank you for sharing your late night Monday night with us. I think it's been incredibly eye opening. I think it's been exciting. It's been dangerous, but I think in the end, I think we moved the ball forward. Forward, Bobby?
Absolutely. Any time that you have people of good conscience having a discussion like this, it certainly moves the ball forward, period, even if it's just with us. It has to. There's a lot of good things discussed. You know, as far as the extent of the media bias, for me, it's pretty simple. If you just do an analogy of some recent history that we've had, and compare it. If you go back to the Kuwait situation, when our government actually made up a story about babies being killed in their incubators in the hospital, and our media not vetting the story, I mean, we don't even have to go as far as say that they were, you know, part of it. We get to say that they didn't do their journalistic job, and they ran with it. And the same thing happened when they signed off on and promoted the war in Iraq with the weapons of mass destruction game. There was never any journalism by our mainstream media, and of course, you had a government. Anybody who even opposed the war, for the most part, even voted for it. You know, we all know what the votes were, because they wanted to be reelected, because they didn't want to be called unpatriotic in their midterm elections, et cetera. You know, and the media buys on that. The key here is lack of journalism. Unfortunately, thankfully, in the same sentence, we have, it's not just social media, we have a number of people out there and organizations out there trying to be true to the journalism that we need in our world. The you mentioned the pictorial I gave you. That was by Minar. I know that Hisham is familiar with who Minar is in Mint Press News. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you know, you've heard me speak about media sources, Intercept and Ben Swan and Amber Lyon and a host of other people that are actually doing the right work, as we're trying to do in Coffee Party as well. That the truth must be told regardless of what it is or whose side it is on. And that's this subject, of course, as you pointed out, Dan, is very tough when it comes to the rights and wrongs of it, absolutely. And it is also a tough conversation to mediate without question. But, again, it is a deep, long discussion, and the positive sides of it are the best. And I think Hisham is a great example of somebody who's trying to fix it, and I certainly join him in trying to do it.
Thank you, Bobby.
Thank you, Bobby. Hisham, do you have any final words for us?
Well, I thank you very much for having me. It has been very, very, very nice, and I hope that listeners took it with the correct intention. I'm hoping for peace. I know that 99.9% of people in the world from all groups want peace, so let's work to have peace.
I love it. Thank you again very much for taking time out and joining us on the show. And best of luck in your election.
Thank you very much. Take care.
You're welcome. This is Dan Aronson. You've been listening to Press One for Democracy. Before we go, a couple of news and notes. There are other Coffee Party radio shows, and you can enjoy them right here on Blog Talk Radio on Thursdays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon on the Pacific Coast. You have Lunch with Loudon with Janine Loudon and Debbie Lynn Moeno. And then on Saturdays, we have Alberto Willis doing politics, right, on Politics Done Right. And that's at 10 a.m. Pacific and 1 p.m. on the East Coast. And, of course, we have a whole slew of other Facebook pages and Coffee Party USA, our main site, which is where you can go if you like what you heard tonight and you want to support Coffee Party. We are totally crowdsourced and crowdfunded and member-sourced and member-funded. So please go to our website if you like what you heard tonight and support us, coffeepartyusa.com. And click on the donate or the join button. And I think it's been a great exercise. I think it's a lot of fun. I was actually hoping we might hear from some of our newsroom. Coffee Party has a project going on. We have a project called the newsroom. I know, not really imaginative, but it is. But right now what the newsroom is doing is they're doing exactly what Hamas suggested, in that they're going out and they're researching specific viewpoints on any one issue, and then coming back together and saying, well, from the viewpoint of, like they're doing the Iraq war now, so from the viewpoint of an Iraqi veteran, what do they think of what's going on now with this resurgence in Iraq? Or from the viewpoint of a mother of a veteran, or a mother of somebody who's killed in Iraq, or an Iraqi citizen, what do they think? And they're coming back and they're bringing this all together, and that is really fulfilling of the coffee party mission in looking at it at all sides. I think Hamas was, that's actually what he was getting at. Don't just assume that you're perfect in your judgment, right? And use confirmation bias. Instead, look at what the other side is saying and then have a reasonable conversation with somebody who believes that what the other side is saying, and then see where you can get to. I think this one's pretty cut and dry for me. It's war, and there's nothing good that ever comes out of war. There's losses on both sides. It's not pretty, and it's not productive. And we need to try to find out, or we need to try to figure out how we can best help stop it. In the end, of course, it is going to be up to the two sides that are fighting. They're going to have to decide, we're not going to do this anymore, and here's where we're going to get to so we don't have to do that. But I think what Americans need to do is exactly what has been proposed on the show time and again, exactly what Hamas said, get off the mainstream media, get off your cable box, get onto the Internet, do your research, find your sources. It's all out there, folks, if we just take the time and educate ourselves. And that's, to me, how we're going to get to where we need to get to. Because, look, in the end, the only thing that I think stops war is understanding just how horrific the outcome is. There are no winners and losers. There's only a postponement of hatred. And until we can figure out how to ban the hatred, then it's just never going to stop. It'll just kind of like whack-a-mole. You find me. I got this one on the head over here, but another one pops up over there. So enough of my pontificating. Again, this has been Dan Aronson with Press One for Democracy. We're here every Monday night at 8 o'clock. At 9 o'clock Pacific. I'm getting it wrong again. 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. 6 p.m. on the West Coast. I appreciate your being here. I appreciate your participation. Thank you to Kirk and Q and Bobby and Kiam. And again, special shout out for our guest, Hamash. It was great, and I appreciate it, and I hope everybody learned something and can take it out tomorrow to the water coolers and to your coffee houses and maybe have a little bit better conversation surrounding this terrible conflict. In the meantime, have a great night. I left my home in Georgia. Like nothing more.